I had a new thought about this text this morning. And I'll give you a bit of background to the new thought. You might remember in the shorter Sukhavivyuha Sutra, the middle bit, the Buddha tells Shariputra how to get reborn into the Pure Land. And one of the things that you have to do is concentrate your mind on Amitabha's name for one night, two nights, up to seven nights. Nights. Now, in the Chinese version, it's days, but in the Sanskrit version, it's nights. And that's always intrigued me. Why seven nights? And then also thinking of Pingya's praises to the Buddha. I don't know if you've noticed, but he praises him every night. He thinks of him, and the Buddha comes to him every night. And then in the longer Sukhavativyuha Sutra, we didn't actually read this little bit, but there's a section where the Buddha says, look at this Buddha field like a dream. Like a dream. And the yesterday it must have been, the Guanjing is quite different from the two Sukhavativyuha Sutras, and many differences, but one of the differences is the descriptions of the Pure Land have much of the same elements, but they're much stranger, and they morph from one into another. One thing becomes something else and becomes something else. Now, you heard some of that this morning, but for the sake of anybody who's going to listen to these talks, I'll just read you. You remember yesterday we did the first visualization, the setting sun. Well, the second visualization, it begins in a similar way. So the first visualization, you've got the setting sun. And then the second visualization, it begins with water. So underneath the setting sun is a big body of water, an ocean. And then that body of water becomes ice. And then that ice becomes lapis lazuli. And then, I'll read you the next bit. The lapis lazuli ground is supported from below by golden pillars inlaid with diamonds and seven kinds of precious substances. These pillars have eight sides and eight corners, and each side is adorned with 100 different kinds of precious substances. Each precious stone gives off 1,000 rays of light, and each ray of light shines forth in 84,000 different colours. When this light is reflected by the lapis lazuli ground, it becomes as brilliant as 100,000 million suns, so that is impossible to look at. And it goes on like this. This is why we didn't do the visualization yesterday. And it becomes impossible to look at. And that happens a few times in the sutra. I think it happened this morning, didn't it? And in my view, it's impossible to actually visualize what the Buddha's asking us to visualize. That may be my own limitation, because I'm a useless visualizer. But I can't possibly imagine how anybody can really visualize clearly in the way the Buddha asks us to in this way. And so my thought was, it's a dream. That if we go back to Vaidehi yesterday, she's lying prostrate on the floor in her dungeon. And the dungeon is the deepest dungeon, so it'll be dark. And she's at the end of her tether. She's probably exhausted with the strain and the grief. And she's lying prostrate on the floor, crying uncontrollably. And she calls upon the Buddha to help. And then it could be that she falls asleep, because the Buddha comes into the cell while she's lying on the floor. So perhaps what happens is she's fallen into a sleep, which is like merciful oblivion, away from the horrible, impossible situations he's in. Just a few moments, perhaps, of oblivion. Blessed oblivion. And then maybe she dreams that the Buddha comes into her cell. And the whole thing after that is a big dream. And this idea is dedicated to Vipassana, because we were talking about dreams yesterday, and big dreams and how important they are. And maybe the whole thing is actually very dreamlike to me. And maybe the whole teaching is in a dream. And this then links up with the Sutra of Golden Light, which Padmakumara mentioned yesterday. The sun hanging in the air like a drum, suspended in the air like a drum. Well, that links up with the Sutra of Golden Light, with the drum. And of course, in the Sutra of Golden Light, you've got the Bodhisattva's dream. Rucha Aketu has a problem, a big problem for him, and to do with the Buddha. And he can't resolve it. So he falls asleep, even though he's not tired. And when he falls asleep, he has a dream. And in his dream, his house enlarges and becomes basically a Pure Land with Buddhas at each of the four cardinal directions. And they tell him the answer to his problem. So Vaidehi has got a problem, a really big problem, which is completely unresolvable on its own level. And she's been trying to solve it, but she can't. So she falls asleep. And the Buddha comes, and he doesn't solve her problem on her own level, but he solves it in another way by allowing her to transcend the problem she's in into Sukhavati. So that's my new idea. And I'm very interested in the imagination and sleeping and dreaming, because this is one of the reasons why I say when I run these events and we read the text, and some people say afterwards they kind of fell asleep a bit, they were dreaming a bit. And I say, that's fine. You don't need to try to wake up. But what you try to do is, instead of fall into oblivion, you try to stay on that borderline between waking and sleeping, where the mind becomes very fluid and things become very imaginal. One of the things I wanted to do on this retreat, but didn't really have the space or the opportunity to do it, was give a talk which would be a commentary on a paper by a scholar called Aaron Hughes. Now, Aaron Hughes is a scholar of Middle Eastern religions, particularly Islam and Judaism. And he's very interested in the use of the imagination in those religions. He's written a book called Imagining the Divine. The book is The Texture of the Divine, I think he called it. But I downloaded a paper by him called Imagining the Divine, Ghazali on Imagination, Dreams and Dreaming. You can download it for free on the internet. I'll leave it out. This isn't the article itself. This is just a few quotes. Al-Ghazali. So as in the duties of brotherhood in Islam, the same. Yeah, so he's a mystic as well as a philosopher. And it's a very interesting article. And our understanding of the imagination, the imaginal faculty, coming from Bante, Bante refers back to the English Romantic tradition, particularly Coleridge. But there's a whole other tradition from the Middle East, coming from those Middle Eastern religions, which is quite worked out, actually. It's very, very interesting. And so Al-Ghazali is very keen on the imagination. He was sort of fighting, as it were, in conflict with the so-called philosophers of Islam, the scholars, I suppose, who put the intellect as the highest faculty. And he said, no, the imagination is the highest faculty. And this paper is a kind of polemic against the philosophers. And it's very, very interesting, and I'd really love to give a talk on this. But I'll just read you one little bit. Ghazali argues that dreaming, one of the primary activities of the imaginative faculty, permits a certain access to truth, an access that is otherwise closed to abstract or discursive thinking. In so doing, he wants to claim that religious experience, with its locus in the imagination, has its own integrity and cannot be assimilated to the philosophical pursuit of knowledge. Because religion is deemed independent of reason, Ghazali argues that the imagination, with its creative capacity, becomes primary. Anyway, I'd love to read you more of that, but I must get on to what I'm going to do, meant to do today, which is to talk about the text that we heard this morning. This morning we heard from the Guanjing those visualizations there where we're visualizing the Buddha Amitayus and his two bodhisattvas Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthama Prapta. So I'm going to do the same as yesterday. I'm simply going to read bits of it and do a commentary on it. So it begins very similar to the way yesterday's visualization began. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vaidehi, "Listen closely. Listen closely and reflect carefully on what I am about to tell you." Then what happened is, as he spoke these words, the Buddha Amitayus appeared in the air above him with the two great beings, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthama Prapta, on either side. They were blazing with light, so brilliant that it was impossible to see them properly. Even the radiance of gold from the Jambu River, multiplied 100,000 times, could not compare with it. Now this image, which comes to Vaidehi unbidden, spontaneously, we have to remember that already the Buddha is teaching us from the image in the cell. Yeah, so the Buddha is teaching Vaidehi. It's the Sambhogakaya Buddha. Do you remember? He came into a cell and he's gold, the color of gold from the Jambu River, on a lotus made of 100 different kinds of precious substances, with Mahamodgalyayana and Ananda standing to either side of him with gods raining down flowers on him. So that's how the Buddha is teaching Vaidehi, and it's easy to forget that. Unfortunately, I forgot that when I was writing the book, so I was unable to make this point. So many points. If I could write the book again, it would be twice as long, so maybe it's as good job I can't. He's teaching as a vision. And then above him, the vision of Amitabha comes. Yeah, almost exactly the same, but much brighter. Now that reminds me that I've forgotten something. I meant to begin this bit of the talk with a quote from Subhuti, revering and relying on the Dharma, but I'll do it now. Sangharakshita suggests that talking about the Gaurava Sutta, right? You know the Gaurava Sutta, where after the Buddha's enlightenment, Shakyamuni, the Buddha's enlightenment, he looks for someone to revere, looks around the whole universe, can't find anyone who's more developed than him, more Buddha-like than him. So he's disappointed at that. So he decides to revere the Dharma. Yeah. So Subhuti says, Sangharakshita suggests that the need to give some content to what it was that the Buddha revered and relied upon was fulfilled in the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras by the image of the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha, so to speak, beyond the Buddha. A few sentences later, he says, this is what the figure of the Buddha Amitabha represents, the eternal Buddha to whom even the historical Buddha looks up. Yesterday, I talked about the fact that each of the sutras was framed by the Buddha Shakyamuni in India. Yeah. And what does the Buddha Shakyamuni do in each one of these sutras? All he does is describe Sukhavati and Amitabha and extol their virtues. That's all he does. The whole teaching of the Buddha is about the Buddha Amitabha, going beyond himself to the Buddha Amitabha. Sabuji carries on, his image, Amitabha's image, is food for the illumined imagination, which must take over and continue where reason has flown as high as it may. So now you can understand, now you can see why we've been doing what we've been doing this morning, this week, the whole of this week. We haven't just been indulging ourselves in some pretty fantastical land with lots of colours in it. Well, we have. But the reason we've been doing that is because it allows us to imaginatively revere the Buddha beyond the Buddha, the Dharma beyond the Dharma, the Sangha beyond the Sangha. I think I'll have a bit more to say that as we go through. So here's this image now. You've got the Buddha, Shakyamuni, shining with gold on this lotus with his two disciples on either side of him, teaching Vaidehi, and above him, Amitayus with his two chief disciples, Bodhisattvas on either side of him. The Buddha beyond the Buddha. So Vaidehi has this vision spontaneously, but she's concerned about us. She says, "Blessed one, through the power of the Buddha, I have now obtained a vision of the Buddha Amitayus." So this comes up a lot, through the power of the Buddha. And she's able to see everything that she sees through the power of the Buddha. As far as I remember, the power of the Buddha is Adhisthana, as far as I remember. But we haven't got the Buddha with us, so we can't rely on the power of the Buddha. So she's always saying to the Buddha, "How are other people going to do this? Please tell me how living beings in the future can visualize the Buddha Amitayus along with his two attendant bodhisattvas." So then the Buddha tells her, she doesn't really need to be told because it's happened to her spontaneously, but he tells her so that we can do what she's done. And then the Buddha describes the lotus. Now this is the second transitional meditation. The first transitional meditation was the first visualization of the setting sun, because the setting sun is of our world. Yeah, so we visualize something in our world, which leads us then to visualize Sukhavati. Now this is the second transitional meditation from the land of Sukhavati, and there's been six meditations on the land, very, very elaborate. And then this one, the seventh meditation, is still part of the land, the lotus that the Buddha sits on, but it's also in a way part of the Buddha. So that lotus takes us from the land to the Buddha. And if you thought the lotus was really, really elaborate and impossible to visualize, well, you try and do some of the other stuff. So you've got this lotus with its platform, etc., etc., but we'll leave that behind. But then he says, "This wondrous lotus flower is brought into being through the power of the monk Dharmakara's vows." So just to remind us that all this is because of Dharmakara's vows. At the end of that meditation, he says, "This is the correct way to perform the visualization. Doing it in any other way is not correct." He says that at the end of each visualization. And I just want to say a few words about this, because why is this the correct way? And it's not the way it's done in the two Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras. This is kind of a different vision of the Pure Land. It's different in many ways. So why is this correct? I think that what this means is that whoever composed this sutra is expecting not just one, but many people to practice it, yeah, a sangha. So it's not that it's correct, but if you want to be part of this Sangha, practicing this sutra, you have to do it this way. So it's emphasizing commonality of practice. You can do it another way if you want, but you won't have anything to talk to with everybody else. You'll eventually diverge so much that there's nothing to talk to about anymore. The lotus flowers will be so different, but you won't have any common ground. So I think this is a call for commonality of practice. You see how I weave all of Bansi's teachings into the Pure Land. Then he says, when you have obtained a vision of these things, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Now, this is what the whole sutra has been leading up to. Its name is the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitabha, or Amitayus. So everything's leading us to this now. So now we come to it. You should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Then he asks the question, why should you do this? What's the point of doing this practice? And then he tells you, the body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the realm of reality. Fajie, Chinese. It's probably not at all pronounced like that. It's probably Fajie, something like that. But anyway, Fajie, which is the Chinese equivalent of the Dharma Dhatu. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas is the Dharma Dhatu. And they enter into the focused minds of all living beings. So there we are again, this reference to focused minds, concentrated minds. They don't enter into distracted minds, only into focused minds. Therefore, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, your mind takes on the 32 major physical characteristics and the 80 minor physical characteristics of the Buddha. This is a very technical and Indian type way of talking about this. So leave that behind, because then he talks about it in a very non-technical way immediately afterwards. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. Not immediately, but over time. When you keep on creating the Buddha in your mind becomes the Buddha. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. Therefore, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind and visualize the Buddha, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly awakened Buddha with great care. And now I just want to rejoice in Shraddhapa's merits. I've been meaning to do that all week, and it's the last day, so I'm going to do it now. And it just reminded me as I've read this bit. I want to rejoice in his merits. It's an amazing thing that he's done. He is our translator in the order, and he's translated these three Mahayana sutras for us. Yeah, this is the first time I think it's ever happened. Am I wrong? I think this book, not so much because of my writing, but because of Shraddhapa's translation of the three sutras, is a landmark in our history. We have now begun to translate the texts, and he's translated it in a way which I sometimes call tree ratna friendly, by which I mean he's translated the key terms in ways that Bansi talks about them. And what reminded me to say that was, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind. Yeah, in the reading we had the other day about the bodhisattvas in Sukhavati, they are ethically sensitive. That came up a few times, didn't it? That is a translation of hri, which is usually translated as shame. Yeah, but he translated it as ethically sensitive. So I think this is really important. I just like to rejoice in his merits and get that on record here. The Buddha continues, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, you should begin by focusing on his image. Begin by focusing on his image. Whether your eyes are open or closed, you should be able to see his image sitting atop the lotus that we've just painstakingly created in our minds, atop the lotus like a jewel, the colour of gold from the Jambu River. So that's the first thing you do. Just imagine the Buddha, gold, on the lotus. When you can see the image of the Buddha sitting there, your mind's eye will open and you will be able to see him completely clearly. In my book, I refer to the Kasana meditations. And when you do the Kasana meditations, let's say you visualize the color blue, there are three stages to it. First of all, there's what's called the preparatory image, where you look with open eyes at the image, let's say the round disc, the blue disc. That's the preparatory image. Then you close your eyes and you try to see in your mind's eye. And that's the acquired image, yeah? Then you can see it with your eyes open or closed. When you close your eyes, you can see it not as clearly with the acquired image. It's not as clear, but nevertheless you can see it. And if you keep on doing that, then the counterpart image rises up from your imagination. And then you can really see it clearly. In fact, Buddha Ghosha goes further than that. And he says, you can see it 100 times more purified than you could see it with your actual physical eye. And he's got beautiful images for this, like the moon coming from behind the cloud. Thinking about that red sun we saw a few days ago, sometimes behind the cloud, and then it come out from behind the cloud, I can't remember now. Read it in my book. So yeah, I think this is what this refers to. When you can see the image of the Buddha sitting there, then your mind's eye will open. Something else takes over at that point. Right now, you're trying to do it with your conscious mind. And of course, it's very, very difficult to do that, as we know. But if you keep on doing it, something else comes up from the subconscious or the unconscious. The counterpart image will show itself to you, which is outside of your conscious control. And when your mind's open, eye will open, you will be able to see him clearly. You will also see the adornments of Sukhavati, which are made of the 7 kinds of precious substances. The ground made of precious substances. The ponds made of precious substances. The rows of trees. The heavenly cloth of precious substances draped over the trees. And the abundant nets made of precious substances which fill the sky. All these things, which up till now in the other visualizations you've been trying hard with your conscious mind to see, now they begin to be shown to you spontaneously because your mind's eye has opened. Visualize all this completely clearly so that you can see it all as distinctly as if you were looking at something in the palm of your hand. And then you visualize the 2 great bodhisattvas, his 2 attendant bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara to the left, sitting on a lotus, and it's the 2-armed Avalokiteshvara, and to the right, Mahasthamaprapta. Now, Avalokiteshvara, of course, we're very, very familiar with, but Mahasthamaprapta is a bodhisattva which we in our movement are not at all familiar with. He means, I can't quite remember, to be honest, but it's something to do with strength, the great power of strength, something like that. Maha, great, Stama, Prapta. Is it connected with your name at all?
Well, when I first started working with Bantu, he thought my name was Stama Shratta.
Ah.
I had to correct
him. Ah, Stama.
Which wasn't easy.
No, no. So Mahasthamaprapta, they sit on either side. And in a way, Mahasthamaprapta is similar in that sense to Vajrapani. He represents strength and power. So in a way, you've got Avalokiteshvara and Vajrapani, but it's Mahasthamaprapta. So there they are, and that's the trio. And as we hear a bit later, they're very important, that trio. And I was saying to someone the other day that Mahayana Buddhism is to do with the with trios or trinities. You get the three protectors, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Vajrapani. You get the Buddhas of the three times, Dipankara, Shakyamuni, and Maitreya. And you also get the Buddhas of three directions. You get, I think I'm right in saying this, you get Vajravarochana in the centre, Amitabha to the west, and Akshobhya to the east. And then what the Vajrayana did, they made everything into five. So then you get the five Buddha Mandala, and the five of this, and the five of that. But here, Mahayana Sutra, you get the trio of Amitayas and his two bodhisattvas. And then it kind of goes crazy, doesn't it? It begins to get very difficult to visualize with any sense of clarity at all. You get the Buddha and the bodhisattvas radiating exquisitely beautiful light. The golden light illuminates the trees made of precious substances. There are three lotus flowers under each tree in the whole of Sukhavati. And on these three lotus flowers sit the images of a Buddha and two bodhisattvas. So replicated throughout the whole of Sukhavati. That Buddha field is filled with such images. I'm looking at my watch and time is going on, so I might need to leave something here. But then he says, when you have successfully focused your mind in this way, you will hear the streams of water, the rays of light. Didn't know you could hear rays of light, did you? But in Sukhavati, you get... what did Messiaen have? There's a word for it, isn't there?
Synesthesia.
Synesthesia, where the senses are all one. So Messiaen's very interesting because he saw music. He saw his compositions. And so here you hear rays of light and all of the trees made of precious substances, the cranes, the Hangsa geese and the ducks, all proclaiming the wondrous Dharma. So that happens. And then he says... you must remember what you heard in your vision, in your samadhi. And then he says, and then after that, when you come out of meditation, you should check what you've heard, make sure it accords with the sutras, so it's not a false teaching, a false insight. And the Buddha does this in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. He talks about the four criteria. Actually, it's only one criteria applied to four different kinds of people. Whoever you hear the Dharma from, and he talks about four different kinds of people, always check that with the suttas and the Vinaya, yeah, afterwards. And if it conforms with them, then you can take it on. And if it doesn't conform with them, then you reject it. So it's very, very important to do this, that when you have what you think might be an insight in your... visualization or your meditation practice, then check that you've understood it correctly. You will have had an insight, but then your conscious mind then interprets that insight, and then it's the interpretation of that insight that can go wrong. If only order members would do that, we'd save a lot of controversy, I think. So, this is the eighth visualization, where the mind is focused on the images of the Buddha and the bodhisattvas. Yes, then you should visualize the Buddha. Understand, Ananda, that the color of the Buddha Amitayas is 100 quadrillion times more brilliant than gold from the Jambu River in the heaven of the Yama gods. Now, I know there are some people who don't like this multiplication of numbers, but I think there's a reason for it, and I'll tell you what I think that is in a moment. Just after we've heard the height of the Buddha's body. The height of the Buddha's body is a number of yojanas, 9 miles, equal to the number of grains of sand in the river Ganges, multiplied by 60 quintillion. Now, that got a guffaw this morning in the Shrine, and it always does, because it is funny. And I can't help thinking that the text is sometimes meant to be humorous. You know, you don't have to take it seriously. It's playing, and it's playing with measurement. So remember the other day I was talking about mitta being measurement and amitar being unmeasurable. And the way they try to get across the unmeasurable to us ordinary people is by taking all your measurements and making them utterly ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous. So this is an utterly ridiculous figure, isn't it? I mean, how can you possibly picture someone that big? And how big is that? How big is all the grains of sand in the River Ganges put one on top of the other? How big is that? How can you possibly know? And then multiplying that by 60 quintillion. I mean, what is a quintillion for a start? So basically what's happening is whoever wrote this sutra is trying to get across to you the unmeasurability of the Buddha's mind. And I have another quote here. This is from one of those suttas in the Pali Canon where Vachagotcha, the wonderful Vachagotcha, is asking the Buddha questions, and the Buddha doesn't answer them. You know those ones. He doesn't answer them. They can't be answered. And he's asking about what happens to the Buddha after death. And the Buddha says, you can't say, you know, you can't, it's beyond measurement. But then the Buddha says, the Tathagata is deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the sea. Yeah, wonderful. I looked up the Pali, as I always do. Deep is Gambhira. Boundless is Apameyo, which means immeasurable, infinite, boundless. Hard to fathom, like the sea. I don't think I can say that. I'll have a go. No. Anyway, it means diving into. It comes from the word pariyoga, which means diving into or penetration. And do pariyogalho, that's the word. I'm not going to try and say it again. Hard to penetrate, unfathomable. This is what the Buddha is. This is what the mind of the Buddha is. And this is what I think the text is trying to do to us. Here's the Buddha, and this is how big he is. You can't do it. How can you possibly see? I mean, it goes way beyond your field of vision. Actually, the Buddha is so big that you're inside the Buddha. Yeah, you're inside Amitabha. Yeah, he envelops you. And from that point on, you really don't have to worry too much about visualizing things very clearly. And then there's this lovely bit, isn't there? Between his eyes, there is a tuft of white hair that curls to the right, five times as big as Mount Sumeru. Well, that's pretty small, isn't it, in comparison? And the Buddha's eyes, this is gorgeous, isn't it? The Buddha's eyes are as clear as the pure, limpid waters of the four oceans. The four oceans. Oh, wonderful. And it goes on in that vein. But I'm aware of time, and I can't do a point-by-point commentary of the whole thing right now. A bit later on, I'm skipping a bit now. This is important, this next bit, and I definitely want to get through this next bit before lunch. Those who see things in their mind in this way will see all of the Buddhas in the 10 directions of space. I just want to say, actually, that, you know, the whole sutra is all about seeing, Kuan. And following on from Satyanama's talk the other day, I don't think we necessarily need to see. I think we need to feel. Feel the size of the Buddha's body. Feel ourselves to be completely dwarfed by his mind. Yeah. And then here, let's translate this. Those who feel this thing, these things in their heart in this way, will feel all of the Buddhas in the 10 directions of space. And this is therefore known as the Samadhi of the recollection of the Buddhas. This sutra, as you know, is thought of as one of three Pure Land sutras, but it's also grouped together with another set of sutras called the Samadhi Sutras, the five Samadhi Sutras, and these are all to do with visualizing Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. One of them is the Pratyutpanna Samadhi Sutra, where you visualize the Buddha Amitabha, so that you get into the Pratyutpanna Samadhi, which is where you see all the Buddhas in the universe. You're living in the presence of all the Buddhas. And this is very similar to that. Those who perform this visualization will attain a vision of the bodies of all the Buddhas. By attaining a vision of the bodies of the Buddhas, they will perceive the mind of the Buddhas. The mind of the Buddhas is great compassion, an unconditioned compassion that embraces all living beings. Those who perform this visualization will be born in the presence of all the Buddhas when they die and attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Therefore, those who are wise should concentrate their minds and perform the visualization of the Buddha Amitayus with great care. Now, I haven't left that bit behind, but I want to read you the next bit because it's all connected. You should begin by becoming absorbed by one of his physical characteristics, tuft of white hair, again, etc., etc. Those who see the Buddha Amitayus will be able to see all of the innumerable Buddhas in the 10 directions of space. There's a really good text which you can get online called, it's called 10 Questions Concerning Pure Land, and sometimes it's called 10 Doubts Concerning Pure Land, but you get both online. And it's 10 questions to Zhe Yi, the meditation master Zhe Yi, about Pure Land. And one of the questions is, as there are Buddhas all over the universe, why should we concentrate on one? And Zhe Yi's answer is, yeah, well, if you concentrate on them all, your mind will become dissipated and you need to focus your mind. So you focus on your mind just on one Buddha, and that is, as it were, the gateway to all of the Buddhas. So again, this importance of focusing, integrating one thing. When they see all of the innumerable Buddhas, they will receive their prediction to awakening in their presence. So there's a whole number of things that have happened here. Let's just go through them. Those who perform this visualization will first of all attain a vision of the bodies of all the Buddhas. By doing that, they'll perceive the mind of all the Buddhas. The mind of the Buddhas is great compassion. So compassion begins to arise in them. Those who perform this visualization will be born in the presence of all the Buddhas when they die and attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. Now we get, when they see all the innumerable Buddhas, they will receive their prediction to awakening in their presence. Those who see the Buddhas, Amitayus, will be able to see all, yeah. All that. Now, all that, you could say, it's a whole cluster of experiences. Or you could say it's different dimensions of the same experience. You know, Bhante, we know about the levels of going for refuge, but one of his lectures, which we don't recall very often, I think, which is the dimensions of going for refuge, the volitional, the cognitive, the emotional, the social. And I think we've got a similar kind of thing here. We've got this one experience, all of the Buddhas, in different kinds of ways. You see all the Buddhas. You take on the compassion of all the Buddhas. You absorb, let's say, the compassion of all the Buddhas. You are born in the presence of all the Buddhas. And when you're in the presence of all, and then you realize you attain the patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. That's the cognitive part. And then you receive their prediction to awakening in their presence. So the bodhicitta arises within you on the receiving of prediction. And interestingly enough, the attaining the patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen makes you an irreversible bodhisattva. So all of those things happen as a result of visualizing Amitabha. Now, this is very interesting because we're familiar with later Mahayana doctrine, where all these things are laid out in a sequence. You know, you make the bodhisattva vow, the bodhicitta arises within you, you get the prediction from to your future awakening from the Buddha in front of whom you've made that vow, and then later on, sometime later, you get to the eighth bhumi and the anupattika dharma kshanti, the patient acceptance, arises within you, and then you become an irreversible bodhisattva. But that's later doctrine, once it's all been worked out. In the early texts, the sutras, it hasn't been worked out like that. And this, I don't think, has worked it out like that. This is all different dimensions of the one experience. Yeah. So I wanted to get through to that before lunch. So now, moving on, leaving all the next bit, but let's come back to Vaidehi, the wonderful Vaidehi, and the end of the sutra. Vaidehi and her 500 ladies in waiting listened to what she was saying. As I say in my book, where on earth are those 500 ladies in waiting? We've never heard of them before. But, and they're in her dungeon.
Yeah.
Must be a very big dungeon. Well, it's not such a problem if this is a dream. Yeah? That's another brick in my argument to it being a dream. See, it doesn't matter that 500 ladies in waiting are suddenly there because it's a dream. Anyway, never mind them. Because they were immediately able to see Sukhavati, etc., etc., and they attained a vision of the body of the Buddhas and the two bodhisattvas, and Vaidehi exclaimed, "I have never experienced anything like this before." Her mind became clear. Now, this is where you have to remember that she's an ordinary person with a weak and feeble mind. Her mind became clear and she attained great realization and patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Just say one more thing. I didn't read the last bit because I wanted to leave the last bit till this afternoon when we finish the sutra. But a bit later on, the Buddha says, if a child of a good family... you should understand that those who recollect the Buddha are like the white lotus flowers of humanity. Like the white lotus flowers of humanity. Now, this became a really big image in later Pure Land doctrine. And Miao, M-I-A-O, Miao. If you ever meet any Pure Land nuns, they're Miao something. Yeah. Miao, that's their name. It's their title is Miao, white lotus flower. They're a white lotus flower of humanity. And this became a big thing. And in Japan, you get this new kind of Buddhist. So you've got Shravakas in the early Buddhism, Shravakas. And then in the Mahayana, you've got Bodhisattvas. And in the Vajrayana, you've got Siddhas. And in Pure Land Buddhism, you've got the Myokonin. Is the Japanese version of Miao, the Myokonin, the white lotus flowers of humanity. And these are wonderful people. You can read about them. They're very, very simple. Very simple. Ordinary people with weak and feeble minds. And they just go around doing really good things for people. They say, we're not bodhisattvas. That's too big a thing for us. We can't be bodhisattvas. We're too weak and feeble to be bodhisattvas. We can't do that. That's for other heroic, strong people. All we can do is, in our own small, humble way, do our little bit. And of course, what they do is actually really, really heroic, but they don't see themselves in that way. It's what I call radical humility, radical modesty. And they just go around doing all sorts of wonderful things for people. And their heroine, of course, is Vaidehi.